Can I go ahead? I absolutely, just building right on that. Terry Bristol, Portland State University. So I started in philosophy of science, and I have morphed into the non-existent field of philosophy of engineering. And one of the reasons is there's, and I really want to support this Purdue program, this idea of forget the incremental, let's have a revolution, because I think that's really what's going on here. And we haven't, not everybody's got figured out what the revolution is, but it was very well expressed there. And that is that the old model of scientific inquiry and so forth is to find out how the world works. But in engineering, that's just background. The real question is, how to work in the world, or in fact, how to make the world work better. Okay, and that's because it attracts people. That's the value issue, and that's what resolves, in fact, the two cultures thing. But the main thing is that we need to address here, and has not been addressed a little bit by the math, is what is the relationship between science and engineering? And Henry Petrosky has a really great book out called The Essential Engineer, which he makes what I believe is the right move. And he says, well, first of all, let's say, inquiry doesn't make any sense if the world's deterministic. I talked to my friend Brian Greene. I said, Brian, you're not seriously telling me that you believe that string theory is absolutely deterministic. These guys are nutcases. You say, I believe, engineers presuppose free will, presuppose we have the ability to change the course of events. We believe that we can change the structure of reality. And that's a very different thing. So we actually have the ability to change the world. So what Petrosky says is everything you thought was science, scientific research, is just engineering research. Okay, engineering is the bigger umbrella. That's the revolution that's happening. And my friends in Silicon Valley already get this. There's some guys at Applied Materials are talking about they want to have a whole series of seminars to readdress to the engineers what their self-concept is. Who are you in the world? So this is not just happening in the university. It's happening in business. Like, who are the engineers? What are we? What are we doing? What's our place in the universe? I have a philosophical background, too. Great.
Me again. I have two different but somewhat related issues just put before you. How to get the faculty to buy in? Forget it. You've already given so many reasons about conflicts, etc. I've been trying for over 25 years to figure out a way to get, because of ABET and other good ideas, ethics into the engineering curriculum. And I've been working with faculty. I've bought their time. I've pleaded with them. I've given them tutorials. Nothing works. So with a couple of engineers, we put together a proposal to NSF, a big proposal that was heavily funded. The idea is create a fifth column. Forget the faculty. Go for the graduate students. Teach them what we want them to teach the next generation of engineers. They're more malleable. They're still idealistic. They're not tied down. So go for the graduate students. The second thing has to do with the self-image issue. I have been concerned about that a lot, and I do informal surveys. I teach intro courses of 300, and they're for the entire university. I ask the question, how many of you got turned off of math? Yeah, a lot of hands go up. When? Third grade. Students at that level are still interested. They're curious. They ask questions. The problem isn't the student. The problem is the teacher. The problem is that the teachers we have teaching math and science, especially in K through 6, are ill-equipped to take an inarticulate question posed by a third grader and turn it into an articulate question and answer it. Instead, it's, oh, sit down.
Or no answer.
And they get turned off. And that may also contribute a bit to the 15, 16-year-old decision because they get some self-confidence. That was destroyed much earlier on. So it's teacher education that's really important here. And that, of course, is dead in the water because it costs money. Thank you.
I'll go back and tell my provost this isn't going to work.
No, that, I mean, it is. It's a frustrating experience, and every day you have to go in and sometimes question why you're doing it, because there is a lot of resistance. There's no way around it. And but, you know, what's amazing about this is, aren't universities supposed to be the place in society to do these kinds of things? And so, you know, you have to use every opportunity to turn the question back around or challenge them. And again, I think that the only way you can do this is by working with the willing and go as far as you can with that. And have stretch goals and keep on working towards it, and do the best you can. The alternative is to do nothing, as I said before, and I don't think that's the answer. And, you know, that's what this is really good about, is getting other ideas on how we might go about making a significant change. Because the woman that was up a few minutes ago that no one commented about, I mean, she started hitting on, you know, why we need to do this. And universities should be leading this. And universities should be leading in K through 12, because they can't seem to be able to do it themselves. That's a whole different issue, because we're trying to do that at Purdue, create kind of like Purdue-branded schools in the state of Indiana. And if you think it's hard to change higher ed, try K through 12 and then get into politics and everything else that's going along with it. There's a lot of challenges going on. But again, I think we need to create models, things that work, and slowly over time we'll make changes. And you know, anything that starts out doesn't necessarily work the first time, but you keep on improving on it and you keep on working on it, and eventually you'll get there. So sorry.
Hi, I'm DC Jackson. I teach history at Lafayette College, but I did get a BS in engineering many, many years ago. I want to give a historical perspective, and it relates to that comment that was done at this microphone just before, science and technology, because somebody who I'm very interested in studying from a historical perspective is John R. Freeman, one of these central figures in the history of MIT that even people at MIT don't remember, a graduate of the class of 1876. And so I've got to, what is that curriculum, you know? Very math-based, but also this idea that there was a humanities. There was things that you learned how to write. You learned how to express yourself. And his great success, he became president of the ASME. He was president of the ASCE. He's the central figure in, you know, New York's Catskill Water Supply, the Hetch Hetchy Reservoir for San Francisco, one of these major figures. But he's dropped out. And I wonder, you know, how does this take place? And it's interesting, he was on the MIT Corporation for 43 years before he dies in 1932. And Vannevar Bush wrote this interesting little memoir about him in 1935. And of course, Bush, I guess at that point he was president, or one of the grand poobahs of MIT. It was this very sort of damning with faint praise sense. You know, he wasn't scientific enough. But boy, Freeman was so successful as a political operator, to be able to, I mean, on Capitol Hill selling this. And I think this is something that has changed. And I've thought about this because my colleague David Billington, who I know would love to be here today, he's retired now, he's out in Stanford, he can't move around very much. He hated Vannevar Bush because he saw that, you know, that speech in 1946 that engineering was basically applied science. Mm-hmm. You know, this is sort of one of these cores. And I've thought about this in the sense that MIT and 1876 was really in many ways what we're trying to get back to. But that world of the 20s, 30s, 40s, and then with the success of the Manhattan Project, Bush, you know, science comes to the foreground. And I think, you know, when I was in school, oh my God, I was hearing about that thermo class. I took thermo and it was statistics. You know, it was just how, you know, what molecules are doing. I got a really hardcore, you know, science view. But I think this is one of these reactions that this is a world, if you're going to be successful as an engineer and you're really going to make, you have to understand you're operating within this human world. And you have, and to bring that into the curriculum. But what I hear is always, oh no, we don't have time. There's too much. There's more math, more science, more technical information. And I think that's really one of the great issues that has to be sort of addressed here. So maybe what we need to do is go back to 1876.
Thank you. That's a good one.
Yeah, I'm Clyde Bryant from Brown University. I just wanted to come back to a topic on education that Sheila, I think you mentioned just briefly a few moments ago, and that is the role of the student. We are tending and often do, and I think there's validity in this, to sort of say the fault is in the professors. Mm-hmm. But there is another side to this as well. And at least my experience with students coming in to Brown, which is the only place I've ever mm-hmm. taught, is that they may actually not be that comfortable with this sort of coach-mentor model mm-hmm. either. And in particular, it doesn't help. They don't feel it helps them score well on an exam or get the homework problem mm-hmm. done quickly. So I think, just as we were talking about it at earlier today, the need to help them learn how to pose a question, we also need to learn how to get them to feel comfortable being coached, because mm-hmm. I don't think that's actually something that they immediately gravitate to, and it's going to take sort of a meeting on both sides to get there.
Just a comment about Yuri Treisman, who's a great math education reformer. And Yuri made, we worked together, he made the comment that the real learning takes place in the sciences, mathematics, and no doubt engineering, doing homework. And that's where the student is least observed and supervised. Homework is a very private enterprise, unless you're in a study group. And he wondered if there isn't some way that we could just direct homework in a more public place with more interaction and more conversation. If homework is graded, of course, there'll be a fear of competition. But I think that's certainly true of writing. I mean, the real work takes place, you know, inside your own head when you're dealing with a second and third draft in the problem that you can't solve. So I'm with you on that. I think we have to ask our students to do more and different kind of work to learn. But, how's that for a summary of that point?
But I think part of it is we have to make explicit what our expectations are. As an undergraduate, one of the things that was made clear to me was that all the skills that made me successful in high school would kill me in college. And very few students get that lesson. But at least in my case, it was absolutely true. You don't work alone in college. You don't, that's the biggest one. And I think we have to be much clearer, you know, in high school, you're taught. In college, you're expected to learn. And sometimes you'll get that by social knowledge, and mm-hmm. sometimes you don't. That's, and so I just think we just need be a lot more clear about our expectations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just think we need to be sure this is part of our conversation, that it's not, if we make all these changes, they're just going to say, well, this is wonderful. I don't think they are.
Right, exactly.
We've got to help them come to this, and we'll get the best place. Mm-hmm.
I hate to broaden the topics at this meeting any further, but let me, it's already been brought up at least obliquely, and that's the changing nature of the professoriate. We talk about resistance of the faculty. Well, it's certainly possible to have a faculty who will embrace these topics. You just hire them with that as their primary function for which they will be rewarded. Typically, those are now called non-tenure track faculty, teaching assistant, teaching associate, professor.
Yeah.
We're certainly doing that at my institution. We're doing it at many. I won't comment on whether that's good or bad, but to be a little bit provocative, tenure is becoming a reward for research and grant productivity rather than a protection of academic freedom. I think that's just what I observe nationwide. I don't know that it will change, but I do know the tremendously positive contributions that non-tenure track full-time faculty are making at my institution, and very many of them along the lines we're talking about.
Mm. What institution did you
okay. There was a question on what your institution was.
Yeah.
WPI.
WPI.
Hi, I'm Thomas Sigmund with the National Science Foundation. My home institution is Purdue University, so I know you very well. From the perspective of a program director at the National Science Foundation, where I lead a program which is very engineering science. I lead the program on mechanics of materials and structures, so the typical strength of materials in the undergraduate curriculum, but what we do in research certainly not the same. But anyways, I would argue that in some ways the National Science Foundation, and I'd like to represent that organization in that sense, actually would help the faculty to be active in that, because we're forgetting that there is an intellectual merit and a broader impact aspect to that. And I really do not see that we have addressed that. So I don't really see an argument of why research active faculty cannot address questions of motivation, at least, through the broader impact. And we talk about how competitive it is to get awards and grants. So why not take advantage of that? Right? So encourage your faculty, if they want to work with the National Science Foundation, not to ignore that. And the broader impact says, how do you address your research in the societal context? Right? This is what we're talking about here in the large part. And so I don't see any reason why faculty should be demotivated. Absolutely, faculty should be jumping at the opportunity that you're talking about here today. So not, don't see this as a threat to the research enterprise or the grants enterprise, if you want to say so. See it as an opportunity and not the other way around. If you don't figure it out, you will be having a harder and harder time at NSF because it's a 50-50 evaluation process on paper. Do we evaluate it always that? Well, maybe, maybe not. But if you have a weak, broader impact statement, you're down the drain in the end. So that's an opportunity. Please don't forget about that.
I think we're finished.
Hello?
Yeah, last word.
One more.
Oh, okay. Carl Pichter, Berkeley. Some of us in the room, I think, are old enough to remember university life before the term research university even appeared. And I want to address the culture issue that has been thrown up so often. If we go back and look at the culture of the university in the early 19th century, and then look at the culture that occurred when the Morrill Act was passed, and compare that to the culture today, you'll see that culture is not a time-invariant quantity. Culture has evolved. So let's ask, where did the culture of the contemporary university come from? It certainly didn't drop out of the sky. And it goes back to the Bush Report and what happened after World War II when the National Science Foundation, National Institutes of Health, and the DOD agencies and other federal agencies had in part of their mission the support of research at the graduate level. That fact started to evolve the culture that we're living with today. It was not a given. It happened. Some of us are old enough, to give an example, I got tenure at Berkeley with never having written a research proposal. It was not necessary in those days. So the question we have to ask, all right, if the shapers of our culture were to change their philosophy in tune with what we're talking about today, wouldn't the faculty go along with that? Unquestionably. Mm-hmm. The faculty became a research, I'm talking specifically about the research universities now. I realize that not every university is a research university, nor does everyone want to be. Many aspire to be, but many or some don't want to be. So for research universities, our culture was shaped externally by mission agencies and internally by the letters and science folks who really defined what scholarship was. And if Berkeley's any model, engineers had a hell of a time convincing the rest of the campus that professional competence and work in the practice of engineering could be evaluated as evidence of scholarly attainment. And all of these things are cultural artifacts. And really, if we want to be serious about this, we've got to go to the mission agencies, and NSF certainly has tried, but we need the whole scene to change if you want the faculty to get on board in the direction we're talking about.
I'll just done. Don, I think,
wants
the last
there,
word.
It's your call.
Tunu Gunaike. Yeah, it's going to be shorter than that. Tunu Gunaike, University of Delaware. I know we're about to take a break, but before we go too far, have we really defined what we're trying to achieve here? I'm hearing three different things, and I think it's important for us to define them before we start going down the path of solutions. Are we trying to bring liberal studies into engineering? Are we trying to bring engineering in one form or the other into liberal studies? Or are we trying to create a completely different hybridized entity? And depending on, or all of the above, Depending on which one we're trying to do, that would determine what we do and where we go. And I would hate for us to have expended all of this energy and things like that, and then we leave tomorrow, and it's not clear what we're trying to do. At least for me, I'm trying to figure out, okay, so which is it? So
that's a good way of
thinking. Can I just well say said. One quick thing? Okay, quick thing. Donna Riley, National Science Foundation. I want to say two things. One on this issue about broader impacts. First of all, Pramod Kargankar, who spoke with you earlier today, is a big fan of suggesting that we coordinate our broader impacts by our institutions and their regional and state level priorities. And I think that's a really important thing that I think speaks to what you were talking about just now, which is that we do need to think about what it is we're trying to do. And if we as a community had clear goals and we could all speak to those same goals through broader impacts efforts, that would make a lot of sense to me and to my boss's boss. But also I wanted to say that it's not just broader impacts. You can certainly address a lot of what we've been talking about through intellectual merit. And I got a note this morning that a new opportunity has made it through clearance, but it's not posted on the website yet. So hopefully before we adjourn, I will be able to announce what this thing is, and it'll be on the NSF website within hours. And I'll tell you about it then.
It's kind of strange. Thank you.
I find it hard not to put in my own two cents here. So I'll save that. But I do think what we're about is really defining the problem. And part of defining the problem is setting goals, I think. In a design process, specifications can change. We're certainly not setting specifications. I do state two design requirements, which is certainly keep it the tent wide open. Engineering, exemplary engineering content from the perspective of the humanities and social sciences. Where that is, whether that's in a liberal arts 3-2 program, whether it's in a community college, whether it's a module that's used in a history course, whether it's a module used in an engineering course, yes. And maybe that because we're so open, or I like to see us stay open, and we have different visions. Actually, I think I was expecting maybe more variety and maybe less, shall I say, consonance or resonance between ideas, between the humanists, the historians, the literature people, and the engineers. But I'm quite surprised that we haven't, that we, in a way, we've stayed on target as far as, as I'm concerned. So let's take a coffee break.
Norman, I wanted to